The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. The International Drug Policy Consortium recently hosted a fascinating discussion on new and emerging drugs entitled Synthetic Realities, Global Drug Policies Beyond the New Threat Narrative. We're going to hear from a few of the speakers. Dr. Adiba Kamaruzzaman is Dean of the Faculty of Medicine and Professor of Medicine and Infectious Diseases at the University of Malaya in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, and a member of the Global Commission on Drug Policy.
And here today we are discussing synthetic drugs, which are not a new threat. And since the Single Convention on Narcotic Drugs was signed in 1961, member states have responded with schedules and classification systems that have not been evidence-based or rationally linked to the harms and benefits of substances, but rather based on political choices. The current international drug control system has brought more and more psychoactive substances under international control, and today there are over 300 substances that have been scheduled. And we have seen the negative consequences of these punitive, prohibitionist drug policies that continue to ruin lives around the world. 6 decades since the adoption of this 1961 Single Convention on Narcotic Drugs. And these punitive policies have been an important contributor to the current overdose crisis related to the synthetic opioids in North America. Now, counter to the intention of drug prohibition, with its goal of eliminating or substantially reducing the numbers of people who use drugs and the volume of drugs consumed, the actual number of people who use drugs has increased from an estimated 275 million in 2021 to 296 million in 2023. There also continues to be a general increase in the production of illicit drugs around the world. The surge in overdose deaths, especially in North America, has claimed hundreds of thousands of lives since 2019. While the total estimated number of drug use-related deaths globally was close to 500,000 in 2019 alone, which is fentanyl and other synthetic opioids have drastically altered the opioid market in North America with dire consequences, particularly due to the historical lack of investment in harm reduction and the continued criminalization and stigma associated with people who use drugs. In 2021, the majority of the approximately 90,000 opioid-related overdose deaths in North America involved illegally manufactured fentanyl or its analogs. It's therefore abundantly clear that drug prohibition, or the so-called war on drugs, has failed at all levels, and we believe law enforcement is not the answer. Indeed, drug prohibition has had a negative impact on the full range of civil, cultural, economic, political, and social rights, and has put people at even more risk, further entrenching discrimination and marginalized populations already facing exclusion and subjugation. The prohibition and thereby criminalization of the possession and use of psychoactive substances has resulted in harmful consequences for the most vulnerable members of our societies: women, Indigenous peoples, ethnic minorities, children and young persons, people living with HIV and AIDS, members of the LGBTQIA+, homeless persons, sex workers, and others. Criminalizing people for the possession and use of drugs also increases health harms. For example, criminalization is associated with substantial increase in the risk for HIV and hepatitis C infection amongst people who inject drugs. And I welcome all of you to have a look at the most recent report of the Global Commission on the impact of criminalization and HIV and hepatitis C infection and how far removed we are from the ending AIDS goals as a result of this. Due to the criminalization of drug use, people who use drugs are also far more likely to encounter the criminal justice system. Therefore, criminalization is essentially a state-sanctioned stigmatization of and discrimination against people who use drugs. Ending the criminalization of people who use drugs, the third of the Global Commission's pathways to drug policy reform, is essential to address the ongoing overdose crisis related to synthetic opioids. Ending HIV and eliminating viral hepatitis as a public health threat and constitutes a prerequisite of any genuinely health-centered drug policy. Another crucial component is harm reduction of any public health and human rights. Harm reduction is a crucial component of any public health and human rights-based approach to drugs. The first of the Global Commission's five pathways for drug policy reform is to put people's health and safety first instead of punitive and harmful drug prohibition. Policies should prioritize the safeguarding of people's health and safety, recognizing the fundamental human right to health. And this means investing in community protection, prevention, harm reduction, and treatment as cornerstones of drug policy. Sadly, after many decades, harm reduction services are not yet widely available at the level and scale required, for example, to end the HIV epidemic, despite all the evidence of its effectiveness. Fewer than 2% of people who inject drugs are living in countries with the UN-recommended levels of coverage of needles, syringes, and opioid substitution therapy. The opioid crisis around the world, whether it's in the United States or Canada or Scotland, with its harrowing number of deaths related to drug misuse, representing one of the highest prevalence rates in Europe and the world, are having a devastating human impact. The Global Commission acknowledges that an unconscionable number of people are dying from the consumption of synthetic drugs available through illegal channels. A significant number of these deaths could be prevented with better access to harm reduction services, such as overdose prevention sites, peer distribution of naloxone, drug checking services, safer supply, as well as access to opioid agonist therapy in the community as well as prisons. There is an urgent need to scale up harm reduction services so that people who need them are able to access them and to ensure that no one is left behind. Drug policies must be centered on human rights, including the fundamental right to health. Everyone, including people who use drugs, has the right to the highest attainable standard of physical and mental health. And this means the governments have an obligation to ensure that people who use drugs have safe, effective access to prevention, checking, and treatment services, including harm reduction services, which should be adequately funded, appropriate for their needs and circumstances, and respectful of human dignity. This is also intimately linked to the Global Commission on Drug Policy's second pathway, which is to ensure access to essential medicines and pain control. The international drug control system is failing to ensure equitable access to essential medicines such as morphine and methadone, leading to unnecessary pain and suffering by millions of people. More than 80% of the world's population has either no or insufficient access to or safe use of these medicines. The political obstacles at domestic and international levels that are preventing member states from ensuring adequate provision of such medicines must be removed. States around the world need to implement evidence-based public health solutions that protect and promote the human rights of all, including foremost the right to health. There needs to be universal access to harm reduction services and to controlled essential medicines for pain relief and palliative care. And there needs to be decriminalization of drug use and possession for personal use, a move to legal regulation, and an end to police violence and harassment. By building on the progress in harm reduction, treatment of drug dependence, access to controlled medicines, and decriminalization models, legal regulation of drugs, the last of the five pathways suggested by the Global Commission, can ultimately reduce social and health harms while disempowering organized crime and upholding the human rights of all. Indeed, in September 2023, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, became the first UN senior official to call on member states to consider the responsible legal regulation of drugs as part of a human rights-based approach to drugs. The most effective way to reduce the extensive harms of the drug prohibition regime and to advance the goals of public health and safety is ultimately to bring drugs under control through responsible legal regulation. To conclude, we understand that the US has launched the Global Coalition on Synthetic Drug Threats because of the devastating situation they face. The overdose crisis, driven by the emergence of synthetic opioids and member states' lack of preparedness, certainly requires the attention of the international community. But we also need to make sure that this crisis does not reinforce the harmful war on drugs. Instead, the international community should seize on this opportunity to fully commit to drug responses that are grounded on human rights and scientific evidence and that genuinely serve the health and welfare of humankind.
That was Dr. Adiba Kamarazaman, Dean of the Faculty of Medicine and Professor of Medicine and Infectious Diseases at the University of Malaya in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, and a member of the Global Commission on Drug Policy, participating in a panel discussion on new and emerging drugs entitled Synthetic Realities, Global Drug Policies Beyond the New Threat Narrative, hosted by the International Drug Policy Consortium that was held November 30th. We'll hear more in a moment. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Dan Vandergouw is a drug markets researcher at the Trimbos Institute in the Netherlands.
About the term synthetic drugs, speaking from a scientific point of view, it's not the best way to talk about drugs, because scientific drugs, as we call it in the Netherlands, is a container term. It contains so many different sorts and types of substances. And for instance, drugs with very different effects and potencies, user profiles, risk profiles as well. And also it includes both substances that are used mainly for recreational purposes, such as ecstasy, but also used for pain relief, for instance, as tramadol, or medical purposes as ketamine. So it has a huge variety of different substances in this term, which is not the best way to address these issues, in our opinion. We also believe, also the previous speaker also already mentioned that, but we believe that drug policies should be evidence-based. It should be based on evidence and not on morals or politics or fear. And having said that, in the Netherlands, we started off in the 80s, or actually in the 70s already, with a huge variety of different harm reduction services. So we have that, most of them are already for 40 years or 30 years. And the outcomes are really good if you look at the number of drug-related deaths, people living in the streets, and access to services and coverage of those services. Think of drug consumption rooms. We have over 20 of them in the Netherlands still. We have opiate agonist treatment. We have heroin-assisted treatment, drop-in centers. An important feature is also Housing First projects. It's really very, very necessary and helpful. But also drug checking services. Actually, I work at the drug checking service as the coordinating office in the Netherlands. And we are doing this work for over 30 years. And it enabled us to quickly intervene when extra dangerous drugs are on the market. Most of these services were also recommended in a recent EU-funded project called SOPREP, Synthetic Opioids Preparedness. It was a collaboration of several EU countries, European Union countries, and they actually identified those services as essential tools for responding to emerging drug threats. As we are researchers, we are in favor of data collection, and for any evidence-based drug policy, monitoring drug markets is essential. We always say in the Netherlands, measuring is knowing. Before you set up any policy, you should actually know what's really going on. Not what you think is going on, or what you may fear that's going on, but what actually is happening in the drugs markets. So in the Netherlands, we have a huge variety of monitors. DIMS is drug checking. We have a monitor of drug-related incidents. We have a THC monitor, which twice a year measures the content of samples that are sold in coffee shops, so cannabis samples. We have a reporting desk on EU drugs, so basically on MPS, in which various labs work together, laboratories, a forensic laboratory with a customs lab, and the consumer samples from DIMS that I work with. And we also monitor our markets, so internet and internet-based platforms such as web shops, social media, and also the dark net, just to know what's going on, to have an additional view of what's going on markets and what may become used or popular in a specific country or a setting or a community. These are a few, I have no time to go in detail about that. These are a few of our red alerts over the last years. Red alerts, we call that, and it's basically the risk is where we alert when we have a drug alert. So we warn people for extra dangerous drugs on the market. You can see a number of these things here. It's cocaine alert was a few years back. It was actually heroin, white heroin, but it was missold as cocaine. People died, and through our drug checking service and our network and our early warning system, we were able to end this situation quite fast. And so basically what happens when we issue a red alert, the specific drug we warn for is quickly off the market. This is the app that we use, so people can use the app to be informed whenever we have a red alert or extra dangerous drugs on the market. So it's really important. A few words about banning substances. So banning substances benefits supposedly include that substances concerned lose their innocent image. It's legal, so it's okay to use, or it's illegal, so it's not okay to use. But we have seen that tobacco is still legal, but nobody would dare to say that it's a healthy thing to do. But on the other hand, ecstasy is illegal for many years and in many countries. But it still has this sort of innocent image. So it doesn't really work that well, banning for this purpose. Also, the fact that substances concern may be more difficult to obtain. It may be true for some substances, but you know, in the Netherlands, ecstasy was banned in 1985 already. But I think that the use have increased year by year and still really a very popular substance, regardless of the fact that it's banned for so long. And also, and this is important, that in the banning substances, they have a variety of unintended consequences. It never or usually does not lead to the reduction in the demand for drugs. People demand for drugs. And when you ban one substance, well, basically, they are looking for a substitute that actually also may be more risky than the substance that's banned. This is really important, and we have seen that through our drug checking service many times, that extra dangerous substances enter the market once the another substance is banned. So it doesn't lead to the reduction in demand, but more to the pollution of the market, basically. So to conclude, so while addressing the issue of synthetic drugs, it's essential to prioritize the health perspective, and therefore governments should invest in the expansion and coverage of essential harm reduction services. They save lives and they are cost effective, and there's so much evidence that they actually work very, very, very well. Governments should also invest in structural and concise drug market monitoring and in data collection. Maybe in Europe, in some countries in Europe, the data collection is okay, it's in proper form, but many countries lack knowledge about what's on the market because they simply do not collect data and they don't monitor anything. Also important that governments address the demand for synthetic drugs, e.g. Invest in treatment or in prevention activities. And finally, address social inequalities as a main driver of drug use.
That was Dan Vandergo, a drug markets researcher at the Trimbos Institute in the Netherlands, participating in a panel discussion on new and emerging drugs entitled Synthetic Realities, Global Drug Policies Beyond the New Threat Narrative, which was hosted by the International Drug Policy Consortium. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Andre Selinsky is a contract manager and executive administrator at the Canadian Association of People Who Use Drugs.
I'd just like to acknowledge that I'm joining you from Turtle Island, also known as Canada, specifically the city of Toronto, aka also known as Treaty 13, which is the traditional territory of many nations, including the Mississaugas of the Credit, the Anishinaabe, the Wendat, and many other First Nations, as well as Inuit and Métis peoples. Canada is often seen as a leader in harm reduction and in the provision of services. I mentioned by some of the other speakers, including drug checking, including overdose prevention sites, safe supply. I'll elaborate on some of those. Unfortunately, these services are limited to many large cities, even in our nation's capital, Ottawa. A lot of folks, there's not really access to a proper drug checking service. A lot of people have to send in their samples to be checked through the mail. This obviously results in a lag time where people aren't getting results immediately. And I use this as just one example of how in Canada we have safe supply, we have overdose prevention sites, we have drug checking, but none of these have been scaled up to the required levels. Canada is a large country with diverse populations, and even as a person living in Toronto, there's only about 900 people on safe supply in the city of Toronto. And in Toronto, in the greater Toronto Hamilton area, there's about, I think, between something like 7 million people. It's just not good enough. If we want to meaningfully do something about the 21 or so overdose deaths that are happening every day in Canada, these services need to be scaled up, as has been suggested by some of the other speakers, and that's why I pointed to my shirt, which says "Every death is a drug policy failure." If we start with fentanyl, fentanyl is a synthetic drug that is used every day in hospitals safely for procedures like epidurals, and people don't die. The reason for this is because people are receiving that drug in a known quality, potency, and dose. In the unregulated market, this is not the case. There's adulterants, including benzodiazepines, xylazine, which is something that was used on animals and previously, and there's very little research on it. Benzodiazepines, I'm sure you're all familiar with, and people are actually becoming cross addicted to multiple substances at the same time, so that traditional OAC safe supply and other programs meant to kind of address the opioids that they're taking and substitute them aren't effective. Yeah. So recently in Canada, there have been efforts by, I'm a member of I work actually at the Association of People Who Use Drugs. We have drug user groups throughout our country who are fighting tirelessly against well-funded, powerful, political opponents who don't want to see, harm reduction succeed on any level. And we certainly need to improve the literacy among the general population, among drug users, among around folks all over the world when it comes to what safe supply is, what harm reduction is, what the evidence is, and what needs to be done. Just to elaborate on safe supply. So the safe supply that we receive in Canada is basically, Caput actually coined the term safe supply years ago, and it was meant to give people who use drugs a safe version of the drug that they would traditionally obtaining from the illegal market, the unregulated illegal market. What we have as safe supply isn't exactly that. People are receiving pharmaceutical versions. So for example, Cadian, Dilaudid, or hydromorphone, Cadian, which is morphine. And the really sad thing is this is a little too late, because years ago when heroin was the predominant opiate obtained by drug users, seeking opiates on the street, those drugs would have worked fine. Dilaudid or Acadian would have met their needs. It might not have been the drug that they're seeking, but at least it would have been helpful. It would have been helpful. Unfortunately, now with fentanyl and the much higher potency of that drug, the safe supply that's being provided, while helpful and important, is simply not enough to meet the tolerance, the increased the much increased tolerances of those individuals. So what I'm trying to say is that while Canada has in many ways taken steps in the right direction, many of these are pilot projects, and some groups, including, I'm not sure how many of you are familiar with the Drug User Liberation Front, but they in the province of British Columbia, they attempted to take matters into their own hands. They sought government approval, they sought funding, they sought to make relations with pharmaceutical companies to obtain a safe, regulated, checked supply of drugs to deliver to people, and they had some highly publicized drug giveaways. They started a compassion club, much in the same model as had been done with cannabis years ago, and everything was going quite well. They were receiving some really great publicity. Unfortunately, the publicity kind of went against them, and some politicians actually weaponized some funding that had been given to them. Dolph had made it very clear that the money used to obtain the drugs, that the checked safe drugs that they were providing, was coming from donations, and that other funds were coming from the funds they received from the government were being used to fund their OPS and their drug checking services. Unfortunately, the politicians conflated the two. It became a highly politicized issue, and Dolph was raided, about 3 or 4 weeks ago. And now that organization is, they haven't, unfortunately, haven't been charged. Well, fortunately, have not been charged. But again, I think that's for political reasons, as people don't wish for that case to go through the various levels of the Canadian judicial system. Even the Premier of British Columbia admitted that while, and I'm paraphrasing here, that while the life-saving work of admitted that Dolph was doing life-saving work, but at the same time, drugs are illegal, and therefore what Dolph was doing was unacceptable. Again, I'm probably paraphrase that in some way, but you can look that up for yourself if you like. Yeah, like there have been so many unjust laws over the years that needed to be broken for meaningful change to happen, and this is just another example. And if we wish to move forward, there's going to need to be courageous people who do things that are not necessarily in line with the current laws.
That was Andre Selinsky, a contract manager and executive administrator at the Canadian Association of People Who Use Drugs, participating in a panel discussion on new and emerging drugs entitled Synthetic Realities, Global Drug Policies Beyond the New Threat Narrative, which was hosted by the International Drug Policy Consortium. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Century of Lies is a volunteer production for community radio and syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's AudioPort service. Find this edition of Century, along with an archive of past shows, at the Drug Truth Network website, drugtruth.net. You'll find a link there to subscribe to the Century of Lies podcast. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long.
So long.
For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.